Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. You'll find vintage classics such as The Lion in Winter and The Criminal, under your skin favourites like Angel Heart and The Wicker Man. Or how about a bit of comedy with Delicatessen or Logan Lucky? This episode, we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of Akira Kurosawa's 1985 classic, Ran. I'm going to be joined by Andrew Pulver, film writer at The Guardian, and we're going to chat about the film and Kurosawa's influence on Hollywood. Stay tuned after the interview as well for an extra treat, an interview with the stars of the new Studio Canal release, The Life of Chuck, Tom Hiddleston and Chiwetel Ejiofor. Firstly, though, my discussion with Andrew Pulver, and here's a taste of the stunning score for the film to get you in the mood. A very big welcome then to Andrew Pulver to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. Hello, Andrew. How are you?
I'm all right, Simon. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you very much. And I have to put you through the usual induction we do on this podcast, where we ask our guests just to give us a little film fact about yourself, a kind of first film you saw, first cinema experience. What's yours?
Well, the first film that I kind of remember seeing, because my memory of my childhood years has never been good, not just because I'm getting on with years, but I think it was, I remember going to see Robin Hood, the cartoon, the Disney cartoon. That would have been about 73 or 74. So I must have been about six or seven at the time. Yeah. And I remember absolutely loving it and only realizing years later that it was sort of an example of the, you know, Exhibit A in Disney's decline. And I had to sort of get back on top from making things like Robin Hood, which was a bit sad.
Yeah, I remember being told I wasn't allowed to like the Aristocats.
Yeah.
Because I used to really like that. And apparently that's a decline film as well.
Anything in the sort of late 70s, 80s is considered poor until you get to, I suppose, Beauty and the Beast was their big comeback, wasn't it?
Yeah, I remember the jump from Black Cauldron to Little Mermaid being on the sizable side. That was quite something. We're here to talk about Ran, Akira Kurosawa's 1985 film. I wonder, Andrew, could you just kind of set that up for us? Where did it fall in Kurosawa's career? And why should we be celebrating its 40th birthday?
Well, in general terms, it's normally considered Kurosawa's last great film, last and greatest, really. I mean, it's not his final film. He did make, I think, three films afterwards, but it really was the kind of last of its kind on an enormous scale. He made many films set in medieval Japan, investigating the power politics and the culture of the time, and really opening it up for international audiences, not just the West, but for all over the world. And I think Ran is generally considered the kind of absolute apex of it. It's on a huge scale. It's also very cross-cultural in that it incorporates Shakespeare in a big way. So it sort of has both particular and amazingly universal elements to it that is just, I see, and looking at it now, it's just an absolutely staggering achievement.
So when did you first see it? When did Ran first come into your life?
Well, I think I saw it when it came out, actually, because I was just looking up the release dates. And although it was premiered in 1985 in Japan, I think it took about a year to get to the UK. So it was released in 1986. At the time, I was I was a student at the University of Edinburgh, one of those pretentious overcoat wearing types, very into art house cinema, and I basically lived in the film house in Edinburgh. So that's when I saw it, and I remember I sort of went to it because it was about King Lear, I think, because I was doing an English literature degree, so I was sort of waiting for a King Lear adaptation. Obviously, went to see it. It was sort of a little bit different. Lots of blokes sitting around on horses, sort of smashing each other with samurai swords, which was obviously great, but in a slightly different way. I think it's the first Kurosawa film I saw, because I must have been in my early 20s. It's possible I might have seen in my even more pretentious teenage years Rashomon or something like that at the Scala in King's Cross, which is another place I used to frequent.
I'm just curious now if we should do some spin-off merchandise of overcoats to watch Kurosawa films.
That was the late 80s, I mean the mid 80s. That's what was being worn.
Well, let me give you a nice simple question then. If you can, for people listening to this who've never encountered the work of Akira Kurosawa, can you just capture him for us and his importance in cinema history?
That is a big question. And Kurosawa is one of these people who, he's such a major figure that he sort of almost transcends individual work and individual sort of time and place, really. But he, you know, he was such a sort of varied and various kind of filmmaker. He came out of Japan after the war, so was a kind of product of Japan's reconstruction and dissatisfaction with the old ways sort of thing. So his sort of early films were about trying, you know, being part of the movement in Japan to try and forge a new kind of culture, a new world for them after the sort of devastation of the war and the kind of failure of what they would consider a sort of ossified feudal system. And his first big film was Rashomon, really, that was an eye-opening success for people in the West, because at that point, I don't think hardly any Japanese filmmakers, if at all, had sort of got out of Japan. But that one was entered into a film festival kind of without him knowing, and sort of won with the Venice Film Festival in sort of 1949 or something, and won the top prize, and that's what got it out. And what he did then was, firstly, apart from introducing the world to this outside world, to this amazing post-war Japanese culture that he was part of, he also came along at a very opportune time where, in terms of our art appreciation of cinema, there have been obviously different movements and different filmmakers come, and the whole thing sort of ebbs and flows. And in the period after the war, Italian neorealism was it. That was what was happening international art house world. But then that had sort of started to kind of die by the early 50s, and Kurosawa emerged just then. So he became the forefront of this new, amazingly exciting type of cinema. Now, that cinema itself then was not exactly overtaken, but augmented and complemented by the new waves that were kind of going on Europe from the late 50s onwards. So he sort of sits in that early 50s period, I suppose.
Yeah.
But what he did and what his films did, they really sort of brought a new vocabulary, incredibly lively, fluid camera style, you know, far more so than Hollywood, which was at that period, you know, exciting after film noir. I'm not necessarily denigrating Hollywood cinema, but it was limited in scope, whereas he had brought this incredible visual panache to what he was doing. And, you know, he just kept on making more and more sophisticated things, like The Seven Samurai, which was released 54, I think. I mean, that was 3 hours long. That's amazing. And, you know, enormous amount of people in it, incredibly convoluted story, but very fresh and engrossing sort of film.
Yeah.
And, you know, one after the other, he kept on knocking out the masterpieces, which I think knocked everybody's socks off until the mid-60s, really. You know, by this time he had won the admiration of a new generation of American filmmakers, so George Lucas, Spielberg. So as his career started to decline in Japan, the support of these people gave him a kind of new lease of life, and that's what pushed him on to making eventually Kagemusha and Ran.
Because he was part reliant on funding outside of Japan just to get those made, wasn't he?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing. Up until the mid-60s, he was very successful commercially and financially in Japan. I mean, he produced his own things and raised his own funding along with a partnership with Toho Studios. But said that there was a point in the mid-60s where he seemed pretty lame, and they didn't really want to back him anymore. And he turned to Hollywood, and he got involved in this film Tora Tora Tora, which was an absolute disaster for him. And the film itself wasn't great, but he got fired off it, and he ended up getting totally depressed and apparently tried to kill himself as a result of how awful it all was. And so at that point, he couldn't really get films off the ground using Japanese finance. But the support of Coppola, George Lucas, people like that, enabled him, you know, they intercepted, for example, with Kagemusha. I think the way they funded it, it got funded, was Lucas and Coppola went to Warner Bros. And said, you know, this guy's a genius. And they agreed to give him the extra bit of money he needed in return for the international rights. So that sort of got him over the line.
Because, I mean, it's worth noting that Scorsese even turns up in one of Kurosawa's later films. I think he's in, he plays Van Gogh in Dreams, yeah. I mean, you look at something like Hidden Fortress side by side with Star Wars, and the influence is kind of written all over it, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's a very acknowledged influence. I mean, Lucas has gone about that quite a lot. I mean, it's quite interesting. I mean, it's not that, I mean, I was actually watching it again the other day. I mean, it's kind of not that similar, I suppose, but I think it's the idea of a kind of princess and these two kind of lowly droid type guys looking at, you know, trying to get her through the enemy lines, is kind of where he got it from. But also, you know, people always point out the costumes are very similar. Yep. In the, you know, the Darth Vader hat, his helmet, should we say, is obviously taken straight from those sort of medieval Japanese warrior helmets and sort of things like that.
The last episode of this podcast, we talked about Hearts of Darkness and the extraordinary film about the extraordinary film, The Making of Apocalypse Now. Reading into the development of Ran, I mean, first spiked in Kurosawa's brain in the 70s, but took a concerted 10-year effort to make. The making of it sounds on the dramatic side as well.
I mean, from what I understand, yeah, he'd sort of got interested, not in Shakespeare straight away, but he'd got interested in these stories about a particular Japanese warlord who was called the Beggar Prince.
Was that Motonari?
Yeah, who had these sons who were sort of part of his dynasty. And he got, and from what I understand, he sort of got interested in thinking, oh, well, and if they were not loyal and disloyal, and that led him towards King Lear. And I think one thing that's really interesting about this kind of King Lear association is my colleague, well, I call him my colleague, my august, sort of one of our august writers, Mark Billington, wrote this article in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago about how Kurosawa kind of improved King Lear as far as he was concerned and corrected mistakes that Shakespeare, he felt, had made. And you can sort of see how, you know, what he means and some of the elements that Kurosawa brought to it, some of the changes that you made, kind of make a lot more sense, or at least make the narrative a lot more kind of locked in and work better as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the main thing is the changing the nature of the lead characters. Hiratori, isn't it? The sort of king who gives away his land, and in Shakespeare, Lear is this sort of just slightly foolish kind of, you know, doesn't really, you know, is not a bad guy, just a bit more fond and foolish, more sinned against than sinning. He's a fond, foolish old man. Whereas Kurosawa's decided that Hiratori is actually incredibly evil, violent, ruthless kind of character. And a lot of the problems that he has in the story come from his cruelties of the past coming back to haunt him. And that makes a lot more sense. It makes Saburo, the Cordelia character, who in Lear gets into trouble by saying nothing, i.e. being a very passive character, nothing will come of nothing, is the line where she just refuses to suck up to him. Whereas Saburo in Ran actually has a massive argument with Hiratori and just sort of tells him that his ideas are stupid and it's never going to work and blah, 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 which is right. But it sort of makes that Saburo a much more kind of vivid character.
I was going to say, it's right at the start, isn't it, that Hiratori just announces himself as the Great Lord. That's going to be his new name, the Great Lord. I might try that and see how that goes. But also, there's a bit towards the end where the way he's shot, the camera's looking up as he's, it's almost like this biblical figure on a precipice as you head into the second half. I'm going relatively spoiler-like, but he's almost deified to a degree at that point.
Do you mean the bits where he's sort of wandering around insane?
The way he's shot, I just thought was extraordinary. I mean, the parallel as well as, to my eyes anyway, because I'm fairly new to Ran, as all these explosions and everything are going off, it reminded me of the bit on the beach in Apocalypse Now, where where Robert Duvall's just not flinching as everything's going on. And there's just like this, I mean, it's an extraordinary character.
Well, it is interesting you say when you draw that comparison to Apocalypse Now. And there's also a bit when I was watching it again yesterday or a couple of days ago, there was a scene which... where Hiratori is sort of sitting in his castle waiting for the armies to come in. You know, that incredible sequence where the concubines killed themselves and everything like that. Astounding. And there's all these sort of things going on. You can see the trails of all these arrows behind him. And I thought Spielberg's definitely watched that before Saving Private Ryan. It was exactly like that.
Yeah, I see that.
And what that says to me, which is quite interesting about the way that Kurosawa's, I think it'd be unfair to say this is all that Kurosawa's about, but one of Kurosawa's many, many sort of pioneering activities as a filmmaker was the aestheticization of violence. And it goes back a long way. And that's something, again, it's not all that the Hollywood New Wave are all about either, but it was something they really picked up on and used themselves brilliantly. And you can sort of see some very deliberate lines in terms of ancestry. And it doesn't look like necessarily that much in the Kurosawa films, but there's a scene at the beginning of The Seven Samurai when a thief is sort of killed by the samurai. And it's in slow motion. And, you know, it's not quite like the Wild Bunch, but it's, you can see the Wild Bunch thought, right, yeah, killing people in slow motion, great idea. Or Bonnie and Clyde, you're like, yeah, great idea. We can use that. We can run with it. And they did.
I found it enormously dramatically impactful when, because it's held quite, it's a good hour into the film where firearms appear for the first time as well. And I'd settled into the film that I thought it was going to be. And then out come a different way of doing battle. And I found myself really unsettled by that.
Yeah, again, that's something, again, I realised that Kurosawa talked about, sort of meant quite a lot to him, which obviously when you're just watching a war film, you just kind of think, oh, right, yeah, out come the cannons or whatever. But I think he'd conceived of the film partly as a sort of showing this sort of pivotal change in the way culture worked, that up until then, yes, it was all about swords and honour and ritual suicide and whatever. And then suddenly along comes rifles, some, you know, the way that his son gets sniped, you know, just completely out of the blue. But that also reminds me of something, again, which I always found quite interesting about Kurosawa, that perhaps is different from later filmmakers, is that a lot of these things, people getting shot with arrows or shot with guns, a lot of this stuff comes from off screen. So he has this kind of habit of people sort of going about the business and suddenly they're knocked over by something, you don't see where it's come from. I mean, it's very dramatic. I kind of feel now that if, I don't know, if it was a Marvel film and somebody's being shot by an arrow, Hawkeye, whatever, they would have an incredibly elaborate sequence where you get a camera going down the kind of whole arrow, seeing the arrow sort of fly out from the bow and then arcing and then going into somebody. But that's not what Kurosawa does at all. It's just like, you just close up on the victim, suddenly this thing kind of comes in. So in terms of action cinema and the aestheticization of violence, my God, it's all there.
You briefly touched on the influences of Kurosawa and on New Hollywood and the movie Bratz. Are there any particular things we should look out for there?
Well, I think by the time Ran came out, obviously the New Hollywood people were incredibly well established. So I wouldn't say, what I do think Ran was important for was, if you think about it chronologically, it was really simultaneous to what we would call what was then called the fifth generation of Chinese filmmakers, which was this opening up of Chinese cinema, particularly, obviously not the fame, but in terms of where we are culturally not unadjacent. And so the idea of, the idea of Far Eastern cinema was kind of beginning to happen at the time. And I think Ran kind of, because Ran was kind of popular, much more popular, for example, than Kagamusha, which didn't really make a huge impact, although it did win the Palme d'Or. Ran, partly because it was about King Lear, had much more of a sort of bigger access into Western culture. And I think along with Chen Gaige and Zhang Yimou, a Chinese, and also, interestingly, a film that I've been thinking about recently, which is The Last Emperor, which is the Bernardo Bertolucci film that was released in 1997. And what's really interesting about The Last Emperor is there's no way that something like that would be made now with a kind of a European director kind of deciding things about Chinese history and so, but I suppose at the time they, you know, Chinese cinema was not as self-confident as it is now. So they had the first stirrings of independent filmmakers with Kai Gao and Zhang Yimou. But I suppose at the time the idea that somebody like Bertolucci would come to Beijing, oh, amazing! You know, this is great for us. But anyway, that's slightly irrelevant in a sense, but I just think in the mid 80s, it was the kind of beginning of the opening up in the West for Far Eastern cinema. And the idea that you could have these large scale films, filmed in this very precise, formal way, which is not exactly what Kurosawa was about. I mean, if you look at stuff like Hero or House of Flying Daggers, they're far more formalized, even though they're dealing with kind of medieval subjects in a not dissimilar way. Whereas Kurosawa was much more kind of chaotic of real and kind of has a sort of intense kind of realism as you know, alongside all the formalism. You know, a lot of people running around yelling and screaming and throwing things in a Kurosawa film, as well as the beautiful paid desert shots. But I think it did, in retrospect, was part of the realignment, if you like, the readjustment of international audiences, appetite for that kind of thing.
Uh, And so for those who haven't had the experience of RAM before, as we just round this bit off and we celebrate its 40th birthday, what would you say to them to try and lure them to give it a go?
I would say, A, go and see it in the cinema. That's not number one. I know you're putting it out on DVD and Blu-ray, but go and see it in the cinema first. It's just a reminder of something that only cinema can do. You're in this room with a kind of bunch of other people, or not with a bunch of other people, but with this kind of hazy, shimmering light, creating these kind of huge pictures in front of you that are moving around. It's just intoxicating, really. And it's an example of how intoxicating cinema can be, really, and a brilliant example.
The 40th anniversary collector's edition of RAN is available now on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray. It comes with 3 discs, a 100-page booklet, 2 posters and the original soundtrack CD. RAN is also currently back in cinemas. Andrew, before we let you go, we ask all of our guests, as you know, to come up with a double bill from the Studio Canal catalogue. What have you picked for us?
Right. Yes, I was warned of this in advance. I have thought about it. My two films, I wanted to sort of try and pick 2 different ones that sort of showed what I personally appreciate about Studio Canal. So the first film I was going to pick was a film called The Small World of Sammy Lee. The main reason I picked it was because one of the great things about Studio Canal, I think, is the fact that, although obviously the BFI is the number one custodian of British film history, Studio Canal has got a very important role because of the ownership history of a lot of those sort of 50s and 60s films that have ended up in the Studio Canal archive for one reason or another. And so I personally would really like highlighting that. And I'm talking about, I suppose, the British New Wave films and all the kind of black and white thrillers that came out at Studio Canal have. And for me, Small World of Sammy Lee, which I've written about on a number of occasions, is really the absolute par excellence of all the great black and white British thrillers, seedy Soho nastiness type films. If you've seen it, it stars Anthony Newley. It's directed by Ken Hughes. It's about this dodgy character who's a sort of compere in a Soho strip club, who's trying to raise a load of money to stop himself sort of get beaten up. It was released in 1962, but it's sort of very similar. It sort of traces its own heritage from another great film called Night in the City, which the BFI have. And the reason I mentioned Night in the City, a bit of self-promotion, I wrote a book about it. So go and buy that book.
It's not work there. I saw that.
but that's the great Richard Widmark thriller, or the great London film noir. That was released in 1949. So, for me, Small World of Sammy Lee is just a great insight into London in the early 60s. And actually, the cinematographer is something really interesting. A photographer called Wolfgang Zuzitski, who went on to be the photographer of the cinematographer for Get Carter. That's probably his most famous film. But he was a brilliant, brilliant photographer in itself. Really amazing. And somebody who everybody should look up. And his son, Peter Zuzitski, is himself an even more famous cinematographer. Did all the Cronenberg films. And only recently retired, so things like Lake of Lunch, whatever.
I'm curious what you've paired that with now. You've sold that to us a treat.
So the second film that I put in was obviously Studio Canal make a lot of great contemporary films. Obviously, they're involved in a lot of French films, which obviously I would like to acknowledge as well. But they also have made some great British films. And one of the films that you have in your library is Under the Skin, which is the Jonathan Glazer, which I'm sure people will know is that Scarlett Johansson plays this sort of shape-shifting alien. I mean, just as an idea, it's just amazing, cinematically, that you get Scarlett Johansson sort of put a wig on, get in a van, and, it was all, as far as I understand, it was all filmed pseudo-documentary that she would sort of walk out the window of her van trying to get people to, trying to get blokes to come in, and they probably all just looked at it and thought, who the hell's this? And walked off, But anyway, it is an amazing film. But the particular reason why it made such a huge impact on me is there's a scene, which I won't give away by talking about too much, but it's, call it the beach scene, which involves a kid. And at the time I saw it, which was in 2013, I had very small children. I think I had a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. I remember being completely taken by surprise by the scene and just, I almost collapsed. I mean, I was sitting in the cinema and I just hyperventilating. I thought I had a heart attack. I mean, it was really, the impact it had on me was just amazing.
Even though I knew that scene was going to have been done properly, I checked afterwards as an audience member. I walked out and just like, I've got to check that like the parents were there. I have to, I know exactly what you're on about. As a parent, it's absolutely chilling.
Is the kid okay? You know, it's just like your apps, you know, people always talk about horror films as your worst nightmare, but that out of a time, I mean, obviously, I was in a slightly sensitized condition. It was interesting because had I seen that film, you know, 5 years earlier, I'd probably thought, that's horrible, but I wouldn't have sort of hit home so hard.
A friend of mine's got a theory that every kidnap thriller, once you've had a child, becomes a horror film. And I see that completely. And Under the Skin, they did do it properly, just to be clear. But it just like, I know exactly the jolt that you mean. That's quite the double bill.
Yeah, well, I'd go and see it.
Andrew Pulver, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for being a guest, and let's go and get matching overcoats. I'm all for this. The 40th anniversary edition of RAN is in cinemas until September. The Small World of Sammy Lee and Under the Skin are both available on the Studio Canal Presents channel on Prime Video and Apple TV Plus. Just time for a quick bit of news from the world of Studio Canal. Firstly, The Graduate is coming to 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray for the first time, and in some style. Mike Nichols' classic 1967 feature, starring Dustin Hoffman and Anne Bancroft, is arriving on the 15th of September in a jam-packed collector's set. As well as the restoration, there's a huge collection of extra features, including three commentary tracks, a 64-page booklet, and a copy of the now iconic Simon and Garfunkel soundtrack as well. The new set is available to pre-order now. And here's the extra special bit of news. Heading into cinemas on the 20th of August in the UK is The Life of Chuck, from director Mike Flanagan, based on the writing of Stephen King. Amongst the extensive ensemble cast for the film are Chiwetel Ejiofor and Tom Hiddleston. And, well, I caught up with the pair in London ahead of the release of the film for this special chat for the Studio Canal Presents podcast. Here's a little clip of The Life of Chuck, and you'll hear my chat the other side of it.
When you look up at the night sky, it can tell you stuff about your future. It won't lie to you. It's pure that way. You might see a lot more than you wanted.
Big welcome to the Studio Canal podcast to Chiwetel Ejiofor and Tom Hiddleston. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
The Life of Chuck is a film that has, the movie world doesn't really generate a lot of sympathy for agents, I've noticed. I think Jerry Maguire sort of did. But looking at The Life of Chuck, that first poster that came out for it, that listed all of your names and highlighted just like one letter at a time.
Mm.
It struck me only would take one of you to break ranks. And that whole poster and that whole camaraderie, which presumably runs through all of this, is completely broken. I looked at it and just thought the negotiating to get that poster going must have been insane. So, I can't wrap my head around it. I mean, it points to 13 actors, a limited budget and a limited time, and just a sense of all in it together. And I'm just curious, once you all get there, is that what it is?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we weren't all there at the same time, but it was an extraordinary time because the film is a true independent. There was no major studio backing it, and it was really Mike Flanagan and his producer, Trevor Macy, putting it together, and we all jumping in on the strength of the screenplay, thinking this is really interesting. So once we got to Alabama, which is where we shot, it was a kind of relay race of commitment in a way. Like, Mike, I think, cast an extraordinary ensemble. And some people came in for a week. I was there for a week, just 5 days. And then Chiwetel, you came in and did 2 weeks, 10 days?
Yeah, I think about 2 weeks.
With Karen Gillan and Carl Lumley, and I think Matthew Lillard worked for one morning.
Yeah. He was out by lunch.
He was out by lunch.
It's the envy in your eyes.
The atmosphere was amazing. There was such an atmosphere of
total,
passion. Yeah. And
camaraderie is exactly the word, I think, and just a real desire to everybody wanted to tell the same story, you know.
Yeah, and so Chiwetel, if I've got this right, because the internet never lies, and it presents projects in the order in which they were released, but clearly not the order necessarily they were made. Mm. Where in the chronology of this were you directing Rob Peace? Because I want to name check the brilliant film you directed as well. But is there something from coming from directing a film where everyone's asking you 10,000 questions a day to being part of an ensemble that's particularly idyllic?
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah. It was before. So it was. It's a completely different sort of world that you're in. It's a completely different sort of headspace, from directing to acting. But the idea of being in a pretty independent space, and so knowing all of the constraints, and it's fascinating seeing different people handle those kinds of pressures in different ways. And I think, Trevor Macy, the producer, and Mike Flanagan did a phenomenal job of organizing, really, and creating a real unity of the experience, So I definitely, having come from a project that was, similar in the sense of all the constraints of independent film, I was really impressed by how they put this together.
There was a lovely interview that Steven Soderbergh did after he'd done his remake of Ocean's 11, where all the cast, the great big ensemble cast, are giving interviews saying they'd had an amazing time. And Steven Soderbergh said something, I'm paraphrasing badly here, that it's all right for them. I'm the one in the middle of it who actually had to wrestle it into some kind of film.
Right.
I'm just curious what the community of it was when you're making it, because you're saying you're almost ships passing in the night a little bit. Was it all of you having a great time and Mike Flanagan stressing at a monitor in the corner, weeping slowly into his coffee?
I hope not. I mean,
if you've done it right, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
We should, we're feeling like, oh, this is going really smoothly and I'm liking this, because it's beautifully curated, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing about Mike. So I think maybe.
And he led with his heart and soul. And I suppose his challenge was for us to put as much heart and soul into it as he was. What was really interesting, actually, the dance sequence that I take part in the middle act of the film was the first thing that we filmed.
Just been reading this.
Yeah, first four days of the shoot. And it was day one. And Mike has said it's the most ambitious thing he's ever shot as a sequence. And I was really aware of how much he wanted it to live. And he and Eben, the cinematographer, had done an extraordinary, a sort of due diligence, but also a kind of short degree in dance in movies. They had watched every dance sequence in every movie and wanted it to be a tribute to those great sequences that, great Gene Kelly numbers or Fred and Ginger. And anyway, Mandy Moore, the choreographer, and Annalise Basso and Taylor Gordon and I, we went off and put the dance together while they were thinking about how they shot it. But if you reference Mike sweating, I think I could match Mike pound for pound with the actual sweat on the dance floor. I burn
We've
holes.
We've never had a sweat off in this podcast before.
Yeah, Annalise and I were out there on the asphalt in the Alabama sunshine. And one lunchtime she had her feet in a bucket of ice and I'd burned holes in the soles of my shoes. So, Jeez. Yeah. We were all rowing in the same direction, I think.
It sounds a really paradoxical thing to say, but was a film like The Life of Chuck a beneficiary of the strikes that were going on in that it had to be prepared and you couldn't change a single word once you were there?
That's true.
Exactly what you were dealing with.
That is true. And Mike has spoken to that. The screenplay was finished and he committed to SAG-AFTRA that because the WGA was still on strike, that he wouldn't alter the screenplay. But the WGA and SAG-AFTRA at the time, I believe, really, really encouraged Mike and Trevor to make the film because it was a true independent and they agreed to sign what was called the terms of the interim agreement. So it's a product of its time in that sense. But also, I'll be honest, Mike had written the most extraordinary screenplay. Mm. It was really complete when I read it. And that was before the strike, I think. So
it just didn't feel like it needed any changing. You know, there's often when you get a script, you think, oh, well, yeah, it's really great, but this and this. But it just felt very complete, incredibly well polished. Yeah.
I can't act for Toffee, and I don't understand the process of acting. It's a completely dark art for me. And it's only on consideration the day after I thought, there's a narration that runs through this that puts an extra slight inflection on the characters that we see on the screen. As much as several characters are portrayed by more than one person,
yes,
there is this extra voice, which in a slight way strikes me as changing the performance and just changing the character that's coming across. Can I just ask my boring question? What's it like to be performers in the midst of that, when narration, if that had gone wrong, would be taking away some of your tools?
That's really interesting. I think I always knew it was going to be there because the narration was in the screenplay, and I knew Nick Offerman was going to be the narrator. And I may even, I don't know if I'm remembering this right, I think he had recorded a scratch recording of
Interesting.
So that Mike could play it on the set. But I don't think we used it every time. And I quite like that, actually, which is that there's a trust and a freedom and a sense of the unknown in, as a performer, you're trying to explore the experience that the character is having. And any edit can inflect or reframe what that feeling is, but our job as actors is just to inhabit the feeling and the truth of that feeling in the moment. And then once that's been captured, our job is done. And I sometimes quite enjoy seeing if it's been reframed or somehow the tone of a sequence has been inflected with something else because of music or voiceover or anything. But I felt that in this situation, like, I love Nick Offerman. It's really wistful and light at the same time. It's surprising. It seems to be have this light strain of, you know, he's very playful and twinkling, and then suddenly he drops into the gravitas and the profundity, and I think it's very moving.
Because I'm a boring old movie nerd, and I'm watching a film world at the moment where material such as this, there's no guarantee that it's going to come out as a film. You know, that if there's a chance to make a 10-hour miniseries of it, and I'm not snobbish about this, but if there's a chance to do a miniseries, chance to do a piece of theatre, and I'd be fascinated to see the theatrical version of this, it feels special to me that this has emerged, and I get it's been protected by Mike Flanagan, as what, a 100-minute movie?
Yeah.
Because that's like the least economically viable way to put this story out in the current climate, to my eyes. Can the pair of you just talk to me about why it's so important this is a film?
I think there's something about, briefly, about the communal experience of cinema, of that you arrive in a cinema and as a stranger to watch the same thing with other strangers. And that's the magic of cinema, is that you experience the same story, but with all, you bring all of your own personal life to that thing. And maybe the film reminds you of a truth that you'd forgotten, or you learn something new, and you laugh together or you cry together, and it has this ability to connect us. It's an extraordinary art form in that way, that it connects strangers together with a shared understanding and a shared experience of the same thing. And I think we need that profoundly, perhaps more than ever. We need to connect with each other and be reminded of how much of our human experience is shared, more than those things which divide us.
I'd love to see it in the theatre, you know. I mean, as well. I think it could lend itself amazingly to a theatre production now that it is already a film. I think it had to be a film as well, because there's a real puzzle in the story that I feel like you want to have that puzzle resolved in the immediate sense. You know, you want to just, I think the real sort of miracle of it, the magic of it, is that you get set up with a puzzle and the promise is this puzzle is going to be resolved in 2 hours or 100 minutes or whatever it is, you know, and the pressure is on the director, the writer, everybody to to fulfill that, and they do. And I think that's what, it's a very fulfilling experience.
So my clickbait takeaway from that is Chiwetel Ejiofor is going to direct this as a piece of theatre now. That's great. Just copy and paste that and put that all over Google. Exactly. I've deliberately gone very spoiler light for people listening to this. Don't let anyone spoil the film for you. It's a treat if you're going cold. Tom Hiddleston, Chiwetel Ejiofor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Tom and Chiwetel. And just a reminder, The Life of Chuck is in cinemas on the 20th of August. I'll be back soon with the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal films as it happens and find out more about the Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram and TikTok. Until the next time, I'm off to shop for an overcoat. Ta-ta for now.